Good morning. We start the week with some sunshine on Ray.
I was just looking at the sky. It's so blue. It seems strange. Haven't seen it in a while looking so blue, Ray. It is glorious. 21 degrees.
It's here to stay.
It's here for the week, Ray. Yeah. It's going to stay until at least Friday. So it's absolutely glorious. Most of the country is enjoying sunshine. And most of the country will enjoy good sunshine. Great week for drying the clothes on the line as well, Ray.
Great drying out there. Yeah.
Carla Weathers, Alan O'Reilly there with Ray on Monday. And from something that's very seldom to something that almost happened for the second time in 2 months.
The acting director, I was told, flew to Florida last night to engage in the investigation. I think that's one of the things that hurt the previous director before she resigned, that she hadn't even been to the location in Butler, Pennsylvania to see what happened.
In this case, former President Trump was playing golf at a course in Florida. One hole ahead of him was his FBI team, who spotted a gun sticking out of some undergrowth.
My guess would be that the Trump campaign is listening very closely to the Secret Service, because there have been two instances now which have directly affected former President Trump. However, he's not looking to back down. He's going to go out and continue to fight. So the Secret Service is going to have its hands full, as it does every day anyway.
Former FBI officer Robert McDonald speaking with Claire. And it isn't just FBI agents that President Trump makes it difficult for. As Donald Clark of the Irish Times explained to Brendan O'Connor on Sunday.
Yeah, I might point out that Donald Trump has really destroyed the understanding of my name. Which up until quite recently, if I was sort of spelling my name for somebody who thought I was Donald, I'd say, you know, Donald, like Donald Duck, or, you know, Donald Sutherland. Now, unfortunately, Trump is always Donald bloody Trump. He's ruined it for Donalds everywhere.
Now, Donald Clark's principal area of activity is as a movie critic. And this week, something straight out of a Tom Cruise movie happened in the Middle East.
All this evening, ambulance sirens have been going in Beirut, where they've been ferrying some of the over 1,000 people that have been injured in this kind of mass coordinated attack.
This is reporter Hannah McCarthy on Drive Time on Tuesday.
What looks like an extremely sophisticated attack. We know that three people are now confirmed dead by Hezbollah, which again just kind of hints at just how terrifying this attack has been, you know, in Lebanon. You know, there was reports of, you know, people losing hands while the devices detonated. So at the moment, Hezbollah have released a statement. They have not yet blamed, for example, Israel. Again, it's obviously a huge intelligence breach for them.
Israel so far has not given a statement. I sent their press office a message and they said that they weren't providing any comment at the moment.
Later in the week, on Morning Ireland, a question you never thought you'd hear.
Pagers on Tuesday, walkie-talkies on Wednesday. Do you anticipate that Israel has more to come?
I think Israel has already indicated that it hasn't deployed all the tools in its toolbox. So, highly likely that some other completely unanticipated, scenario could unfold in Lebanon.
This is Professor Lina Khatib from the SOAS University in London.
This kind of operation is about stunning your opponents. And this is something that Israel is now trying to demonstrate superiority in doing.
And later that Thursday, it looked as if things were spiralling.
There have been extensive exchanges of fire across the Israeli-Lebanon border. The Israeli military says it conducted airstrikes overnight on multiple targets in southern Lebanon. Beirut International Airport has banned passengers from carrying pagers and walkie-talkies on board any aircraft.
It was a good week for Irish law enforcement, who, in common with international forces, scored a major victory in their war on criminal gangs.
Well, this operation, Rachel, has been led by the Garda Drugs and Organised Crime Bureau. It involves over 100 officers from different units all over the country.
From the News at 1 on Tuesday, here's Paul Reynolds.
Garda searched a remote farmhouse in County Wexford last night, and they discovered over 100 kilos of cocaine concealed in an articulated truck on the farm. Four people, middle-aged men, were arrested at the scene. A substantial amount of cash, we believe around €300,000, has also been seized. Garda say it's still being counted.
Tell us then what you can tell us, I suppose, about this group, this gang, the family.
Well, the family, as the name obviously suggests, is a family-based organised crime group run by brothers from West Dublin, but also nationally through its links with other criminal gangs and transnational suppliers. And it has quietly established itself in recent years. While the focus had been on the Kinahan organised crime group, €3 million in cocaine was seized from it last July when the Gardaí raided a house in Clondalkin. And there's also been other multi-million euro seizures from the gang over the past year.
And there was much more detail on Wednesday's Today programme with Claire Byrne about the Ghost telecommunications network.
Ireland had the second largest user base of this particular encrypted platform, so the success of this operation is of particular significance to us. We targeted four Irish organised crime groups who are involved in drugs trafficking. We also targeted the key facilitators of this encrypted phone network and importantly seized a number of the suspect handsets.
We also heard from representatives of the Gendarmerie and the Australian Federal Police.
This was a truly global game of cat and mouse, and today the game is up. It was about bringing together the right people with the right tools and the right expertise, ensuring that every aspect of this complex operation was covered. We know how these criminals operate. We know how to find them. And as today shows, we know how to stop them.
Our response in Australia was to establish Operation Kraken, which had two key goals. The first being to help take down the Ghost platform, and secondly, to bring its administrator, a 32-year-old Australian man from New South Wales, to account. As a result of our efforts, we will allege hundreds of criminals, including Italian organised crime, outlaw motorcycle gangs, Middle Eastern organised crime and Korean organised crime have been using Ghost in Australia and overseas to import illicit drugs and to order the killing of individuals involved in various criminal enterprises. Significantly, during our investigation, the AFP and local partners prevented the death and serious injury of as many 50 individuals in Australia, all by virtue of our access to messages on the Ghost platform. And while there are 50 people alive today as the result of our work, there are another 50 people in Australia, users of the Ghost platform, who are now facing criminal charges.
And the original begetter of the Ghost network, Paul Reynolds again.
This system was set up 9 years ago by a 23-year-old man in Sydney, Australia, who lived with his parents. He launched the network and began building dedicated encrypted communications devices. He's then alleged to have sold those DECDs for about $2,500 Australian to criminals. The success of them, as far as they were concerned, went global because he used a network that vetted new Ghost users before they were allowed into the system. Australian police have identified about 600 of them and 200 of them have gone global. Now, the Gardaí estimated that of those 200 that went around the world, 100 of them ended up in Ireland, and they have seized 42 of those, and they say that they believe they've only seized 42 because criminals are by nature very cautious. 51 people in total have been arrested in four countries, 11 in Ireland, 38 in Australia, and one each in Italy and Canada. A drug lab was also dismantled in Australia. Weapons, drugs, and over €1 million worth of cash has been seized globally so far.
RTE's crime correspondent Paul Reynolds there on how they took down the Ghost platform. Well, playback this week is pretty much a politics-free zone. But on Saturday, former Green Party leader Eamon Ryan joined Brendan O'Connor. He spoke about his son Tommy, who's now 23.
For the first 3.5-4 years, no real sense of any, you know, Tommy met all his markers, met all his kind of tests and so on. But at about the age of 4, it kind of disintegrated, and it was really scary, particularly for my wife. It was just at the time, actually, that I became a minister first in 2007. He literally went from being a sort of very happy, attentive sort of child, you know, normal focus, and to being deeply distressed, not able to cope, just starting in school in Nenagh, but just completely unable, tantrums, distraught. He had subsequently, I think it's called childhood disintegrative disorder. It's about 1 in 100,000 children that typically develop it. It's a late onset autism. Tommy, when he was young, 4, 5, 6, would have been kind of, as I said, quite attentive, but increasingly became more inward, maybe, to put that word in it. We went into the health system looking for help. I think maybe a lot of our systems are not, haven't caught up yet in terms of their mixing kind of, you know, I mean, our original experience, first experience, well, what have you done? Is this something environmental? Like, did something happen at home? And it was.
This is from a doctor or a psychiatrist?
Yeah, psychiatrist. Yeah, it was very outdated and very completely ineffective. We had to go for private. And again, most parents with autism will be very familiar with this because the system wasn't really providing a diagnosis for us. We went to get a private diagnosis, which did immediately, fairly kind of instantaneously, your child is on the spectrum, your child has an intellectual disability. A lot of parents with autism would be very familiar with
that. How long did it take? How long were you dealing with the public system before you got?
Well, we still are.
Yeah, but I mean, before you started getting anywhere.
It would have been 3 years.
3 years to get a diagnosis.
Pretty much, 2 to 3 years, yeah.
And that time is ticking away as well, all the time for intervention. I mean, were you coming in every day railing at your colleagues, at fellow ministers?
Yeah, my colleagues will know I do speak in cabinet and I do. I mean, you have to share your experiences to inform your kind of input. So yes, I do. Like, our system is not serving autistic children and young adults. That's absolutely clear. You can look at the newspaper headlines today. There are 160 children out there who do not have a school place. Even 21 years, 23 years after the County Synod case, we haven't had a day's respite in 5 years, you know, since he was 18.
When you say we're a very caring country, you see, a lot of it gets pushed back on the parents, doesn't it?
Yeah, quoting my wife once, says they say we're moving to care and community. They mean me.
Yeah.
You know, it's on the parents' shoulders.
And an example of how those shoulders can be under pressure, John Fogarty, GAA correspondent with the Irish Examiner and father of Grace.
It was tough for my wife. It was one of those infamous 90 minutes assessments. I was in the car park. Ollie was being minded. My wife, Sharon, was in with Grace, and she came out, and it was obvious that there was something wrong.
You knew, I mean, you both knew that something wasn't right here, but it's different when someone tells you that something isn't right, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's a different thing altogether.
It's completely, but we were hearing that from childminders as well, which is obviously difficult, like, you know, we wanted the two of them being minded, of course. Yeah, to hear from different people, but also to hear from experts. Well, we haven't been hearing too much from experts in the last few years, to be honest with you, Claire.
Right, and that's what you're writing about. So you got your assessment of need. What happened then?
The service statement is supposed to come a month after that, Claire. We didn't see head nor tail of that for, I think it was a year and a half now, correct me if I'm wrong. The service statement, basically the AON, the assessment of need, stipulated that Grace required occupational therapy, speech and language and psychology. We have received none of that. The service statement eventually came after a complaint, after a upheld complaint, after an appeal. It eventually came, and now this year, it was supposed to be reviewed in May. We have learned now that it's going to be reviewed next month.
So none of the services you were told you needed and Grace needed, you haven't had any of them,
none
is that what
of
you're
them.
Saying?
No, we're on waiting list privately as well, Claire, but no, we've got nothing for that. I'm not a figurehead. I'm just a father, to be honest with you. I'm a Gaelic Games correspondent, but I'm a father. I have enough energy for Grace and my family, but I don't know if I can be a figurehead for everybody. As much as, you know, a piece like this, I'm glad I wrote it because it's brought people together. They're not alone. And Grace's story is the story of so many children out there.
You know, when you hear about that window, is that your fear that you're up to nearly, is it 4 years between the assessment?
Yeah, it will be going on 4 years. It's actually this week, 3 years, but it is going on 4 years in terms of the whole process, Claire. Yeah, the window is narrowing. It's narrowed. It's already gone for so many children out there. It's narrowing on Grace. We're very realistic. I would have had dreams, aspirations of, you know, walking possibly Grace up the aisle and things like that. That mightn't be possible. And that's hard to take. But when you're told by the system to manage your expectations, it's so cruel. It's brutal.
Mm-hmm.
If what I'm getting is a reflection of a cross-section of society, this is going to be a huge campaign issue there. And it's timely for Simon Harris. He knows it was autism that basically inspired him to do what he did for his brother. And what As I Am are a great group. They're a great charity and they have helped us down the line as well. But the proof will be in the pudding. Colour me impressed until I see action. And they're saying 18 months, best of luck with that. I'm not seeing it. They're coming up against a system that is faceless a system that has become desensitized because they're saying no so many times to people. And I just wonder how you can turn that around. It's a culture at this stage, Claire, and I wish him the sincere best of luck in it, but I would question just how much authority he has in that regard.
John Fogarty with Claire on Thursday. Back in a minute. You're welcome back. For the next while, some glimpses of another Ireland. On Tuesday, Oliver Callan's guest for the entire programme was Roddy Doyle. In 1994, he wrote Family, a four-part TV drama which was shown on RTE within a week of the Riverdance Eurovision. Nobody, least of all Doyle, could have foreseen the reaction.
I got, you know, more than one letter claiming it didn't happen in Ireland and that if I wanted to do it, I should have set it in England. The BBC should have set it in England, not in Ireland. Yeah. From the pulpit, apparently, there was several accusations that I was undermining Irish marriage. That's what I was trying to do. Marriage quite easily undermines itself on a regular basis. It doesn't need help from me. I open up an envelope one morning and there's a death threat in it. Somebody, and there's a photograph of myself from a newspaper with dead written across the forehead, you know. Couldn't help thinking about somebody went to the trouble of getting an envelope, getting a stamp, putting that in the envelope, going down to a post box, putting it, I think it was Roddy Doyle, CO, care of RTE, and eventually found its way to me.
Not the sort of fan mail that any writer wants to get. And there was more to come, as Doyle explained.
Eamon Dunphy wrote a hatchet job on me. Fair enough, he's totally entitled to. And I wrote a little reply, but they published my address. Not just the area I lived in, Colester, my whole address. There was a deluge of letters then after that.
And you have small children at home?
We had two at the time, yeah, three and two. So even something as small as going down to the shops for a bottle of milk, for a few days I was saying, no, I'd better not, I'll just go on my own. At home.
Roddy Doyle from the Oliver Callan Show on Tuesday morning. And as with everything else on Playback, all of these longer features are available on the RTE radio player and on the RTE website and wherever you get your podcasts. Over on Liveline, Joe Duffy and team started the week where they left off the previous week. And the picture of corporal punishment in Irish schools was relentless. Here's Jim.
Well, like, when I say hit you, Joe, I don't mean like just giving you a whack. I mean full force. Doing 12 of those on the trot now, I never got 40. And the guys in the class, outside the class, they used to think, ask to see my hands because they thought they were made of leather. They used to say O'Brien's hands are made of leather. But by God, the pain. You couldn't hold anything, obviously, for a long time after. And you'd sit down and then next day, same again.
William remembered going to school and the teacher had two leathers, named after a popular RTE TV show at the time, Traum agus Éithrim.
And if you were called to the top of the class, these letters were in a mahogany box that was fur-lined. And he gave you the choice then of Traum or Éithrim. And he would just hammer you. He took such pride in his two letters inside in his box.
Okay, Traum agus Éithrim, one light, one heavy. Was one easier as punishment?
The first time you got it, right, you would say, I'll take the light one. And then after that, you said you'd take the heavy one. But after you got the two of them for the first time, you always took the heavier one because he didn't seem to be able to swing his hand as fast with the heavier one. But he could hit you 15 to 20 times. Another teacher who would get the duster, get you to form a knuckle, and basically he'd keep knuckling you until your knuckles were bleeding.
It was a rough week on Liveline. Here's Maureen, also from Monday's programme.
I was left-handed and I had red hair. And by God, the nuns hated those two combinations. So you'd be called stupid, your hair would be pulled, and she used to have a leather belt with keys on the end of that belt. Mm. And she would whack them keys into your fingers, my left hand, which my knuckles were always bleeding. And then one day she just took it too far. And then I felt this, like, hot, a sharp pain, and I put my hand up and there was blood everywhere, and big panic then. And I was crying. They had a thing about left-handed people. And you're called, you're the devil's child and you're never any good. The doctor was called, there was a man called from the next village and he came and I got stitches in my head. I still have the scar to this day.
Michael served his time in the saddler's trade.
Started at the age of 13, Joe.
So you were only a child. And then this Christian brother arrives in your workplace. What happened?
Just walked in, had a quick look around. He pulled out this leather strap from underneath his coat or his uniform as it wore at the time.
Yeah.
And he just said to me, he said, you know what that is?
Yeah.
I said, I do, yeah. And he said, could you make something like that? I said, I could, yes. We can make something like that. And he said, would you be interested in making stuff? And I said, no. This was a strap jaw that was approximately 10 to 12 inches in length, about 1 3/4 to 2 inches wide, and it was just cut square on the very end. And the hand part of it was pre-shaped like the handle of a sword.
Good picture.
And at the back of at the small finger, there was like an anchor shape so it couldn't slip out of his hand.
Yeah.
Double stitched all round, and in the middle of the fat part of the white part, there was another 2 or 3 rows of stitching on the inside of it. The one thing that caught my attention actually was it wasn't beveled. The leather wasn't beveled at all.
Yeah.
The edges of the leather, the sharpness of the leather was still there.
When Olive was in school, she was delighted with her pink hairband.
The teacher, lady teacher, came up behind me and she wrapped me on the top of the head with her knuckles.
Okay.
And I had an excruciating pain in my head.
Yeah.
I went to the bathroom at lunchtime and took off the hairband, and there were 3 teeth missing off the hairband, and there was blood on it.
Yeah.
So I had kind of a little spot about the size of a pea on my head, you know.
Mm. And Olive, did you think the 3 missing teeth, do you think they were in your hair? Did you try and comb them out? Did you...
No, I just ignored it because being a child, I put the hairband back on and got on with it, you know.
Okay.
It was quite some time later when I realised what had happened 40 years later.
Oh, my God.
You just sucked it up and you wouldn't dream of saying anything because if you said anything, her weapon of choice was actually the bar of a cot.
Yeah.
That was... what she used for a stick. I left school, went to Dublin, married, settled down, and I went to get my hair done there on the barn, and the hairdresser handed me a very discreet note that said, I'm sorry, I cannot do your hair as you have a lump on your head. Please see your doctor. My GP was great, and I called into him on the way down, and I said, well, the only thing I can ever think happened to my head was that when I was in school, teacher hit me over the head for talking. I was missing teeth off a hairband. He gave me an anaesthetic and he got a scalpel and he started to root about. And he handed me 2 plastic teeth, perfect pink plastic teeth.
For Peter, it was a different sort of teeth.
I had braces fitted on my teeth in 1968 when I was 10 years of age.
Okay.
Top and bottom up in the dental hospital in Dublin.
Yeah.
Got them fitted on a Monday. And I came into school on a Tuesday and the master asked me a question and the pain of the bloody braces and they were drooling and dribbling. He thought I was eating a sweet. And I can still see to this day, 56 years later, running at me. And I thought he was going to hit me a box on the shoulder, but he hit me a box straight into the mouth. Bursted my gums, broke the braces and a mouthful of blood came out on the floor. 10 years of age. My dad used to work very early in the morning. And when he discovered what happened, he waited until the end of school time and he brought me up the road and into the classroom where the master was still there, the kids, everybody was gone home at this stage, and he grabbed him by the throat and I thought he was going to kill him. And he pushed him up against the wall and he urinated on the floor, the teacher did. When he seen this happening, he dropped him. But I remember having to go back up to the dental hospital. We travelled by bus that time. I went into the dental hospital and I opened my mouth and the dental surgeon, where are your teeth? Where's your braces? And I had them in the hanky and she hit me. Oh, God almighty, she hit me. But when I told her the story, she was very sympathetic and repaired them. And I still have all my teeth to this day, believe it or not, 66 years of age. But those are horrendous times.
All week on Liveline, I've been bewildered by the ingenuity of the punishment and the triviality of the so-called reasons. Listen to Mary.
She asked me to trace a river on the map on the blackboard. And I traced it the wrong way instead of from the source. So she hit me across the head and my head then hit off the blackboard.
For another Mary, the problem was Norway.
I can distinctly remember one day being asked where Norway was. And I was looking up at a map with Norway, Sweden and Denmark. And I knew where Norway was.
Of course.
But I was afraid to answer because I was afraid the answer would be wrong. He said to me, the county home will be the end of you. So don't bother trying to find out where Norway is.
Charlie's tormentor referred to his method as the Chinese torture.
He squeezed the four fingers, Joe.
Yeah.
Until the blood went up to your fingers. Your four fingers were filled with blood. And then he took out a ruler and he tapped the top of your fingers like that.
Yeah.
Until the pain was excruciating. But the pain actually got worse afterwards when the blood started to return back into your fingers. He called it the Chinese torture.
Once again, they tried to beat the left-handedness out of people.
I was too quiet, the nun said, because I was left-handed. She'd tie my hand behind my back so I'd write with my right hand. So she said, I'm going to teach you a lesson. So she locked me down in the black room. She locked the door. I don't know what length of time I was down there. I can't remember what length, but it seemed a long, long time.
Of course.
And then she came and took me up and put me back into class, and she said, that'll teach you. If you're quiet in class anymore, you'll go down there again.
And just when you think you've heard it all, listen to Harry.
There was a brother, a Christian brother, in a class a couple of years later, whose method of chastisement was to grab people by the head and then bite their noses. Looking back on this, I thought, I must really be dreaming this.
Yes.
Until about 25 years ago,
okay.
I went to a reunion. I said, was there a brother? And he stopped me.
Mm-hmm.
And he named a brother. And he said, that fellow was well known for doing this, grabbing young lads' heads and then biting them.
George used to regularly go back to school after lunch with a few sweets in a bag.
The headmaster passed me and he took a bag of sweets off me. And I go down and I'd be watching him for the rest of the day eating my rum and butters. But he did it a few times and I got fed up. And
good
I was going back after lunch one day and I bought a bag with me and I filled the bag with calf nuts.
Good calf nuts, yeah. Good enough.
Yeah.
Good enough.
And I went up and I was moving my mouth as if I had a sweet in it. And he was, and the finger went up again, called up, and I left the bag on his desk. And I went down and I was looking at Nick's and the hand and out.
Yeah.
Calf nuts was into the mouth. Oh, Jesus, what a face. But he got such a shock, all he could do was smile down his face.
Ah,
he never took a sweet on me again.
I know, he didn't.
But it was almost worth sitting through five forensic listens to Liveline for that glorious cackle of support from Joe. All this week on Liveline. Back to Brendan O'Connor and back to the West. Poet Rita Ann Higgins has a new book out. She spoke about her father to Brendan.
He wouldn't give me away. But he came to the wedding in the afternoon. He came later to the wedding.
But explain. So did
he wouldn't give me away. He said, no, I'm not doing it. And I had to go to the priest.
Why?
It wasn't anything to do with Christy because he really liked Christy. He just wouldn't do it. And then he turned up in the afternoon. Now, it was a Sunday wedding. I can't remember his reasons, but there was conflict right there and then that he wasn't going to give me away. And my brother gave me away. But then
you were only 18.
Yeah, that's right. So
that's kind of upsetting, isn't it?
It was. It was upsetting. But, you know, it was just a thing. Like, what other template had I? This was my first marriage, for God's sake. It could have been a narcissistic personality thingy, but I'm not sure. I'm not a specialist. Or
and that he thought you were going to have a better life than he had or something, yeah?
Something like that. Couldn't figure it out. He didn't do it with my sister.
And despite the most fractious of fatherly relationships, she still wrote about him.
It was called Pater, because I would, the Latin for father. And in the poem I said, I was dodging him for years. Now he's dead, I'm dying for his shadow. Simple as, that was the poem.
Rita Ann Higgins' poetry, like herself, is rooted in Galway. Here's a part of My Mother Loved Me in Red.
My mother loved me in red. She would say, red is lovely on you. She told me this not often, but as often as she could while the other 10 were out of earshot, which in truth was as likely as a lunar eclipse, a ghost rainbow, or meeting a natterjack on the run.
Rita Ann Higgins from the Brendan O'Connor programme. And meeting a natterjack on the run is probably as rare as meeting a zonkey. Sharon Shannon, box player to the stars, was in with Marty Whelan on Lyric during the week, and the conversation turned, as it inevitably does on Marty in the Morning, to the zonkies of Eastkey.
There are two zonkies in Eastkey, and I was saying, what are zonkies?
Yeah.
They're a cross between a zebra and a donkey.
Right.
And apparently there was two zebras left behind after a zoo or something.
And the donkeys took to them, as
yeah,
it were.
Apparently, yeah, they can breed and
and what do they
and
look
make
like?
Little baby,
as
baby
as
donkeys.
What do they look like?
They're like little donkeys.
Donkeys with stripes.
Donkeys with stripes. Swear to God, if you Google it, you'll
see. We'll have to Google it. Well, listen
but
to the track
But the little donkeys
anyway.
Themselves can't reproduce.
And you'll have time to Google it right now. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back. As ever, the weekends are full of sport on radio. On Countrywide, Brenda Donoghue met some GAA folk to talk about the decline in numbers in some places and the decline in clubs in others.
One of the things that we're going to have to look at is numbers. You know, so traditionally GAA games, Gaelic games are 15 a side.
This is the entirely appropriately named Benny Hurl, the GAA's demographic czar.
So, for example, in Corla, they're going to play a championship on Sunday, a junior shield, and they have had to get special permission from Cavan to play a 13-a-side. So I'm talking to some of the lads here, and they're saying, look, you know, at a stretch, it will be 13-a-side. They may have to get somebody out of England or some to come and make up 14 or 15. Numbers are a big issue in rural Ireland. In urban centres, there are too many players. And they can't physically get games. There are not enough clubs, there are not enough teams, there are not enough pitches to play on.
When we're looking at news about GAA, we're talking about moving championship dates and all these other issues. But you believe that this is the most critical issue for the GAA is demographics.
Let's take South Kerry, for example. I think there's 11 clubs down there. I'm not sure if any of them are able to field independently. All of these clubs that currently are under pressure are going to be forced to amalgamate. Nobody wants that. Like the people here in Corla, they want to wear their own jersey. They don't really want to be amalgamated with another team. You know, so if, as a consequence of doing nothing, you know, so many clubs go out of existence and amalgamate, then the GAA overall is a weaker organisation, and that's not a good thing.
Brenda Donoghue reporting there for Countrywide. Similar concerns in Dundalk, with a big gathering of supporters of the football club outside Oriel Park on Monday evening. Tony O'Donoghue was there for drive time.
Well, I don't know if you can hear it just all around me here now. There's actually hundreds of fans have arrived, more than I expected actually, with all their colours, their flags, their banners, the Lily White Army, they're saying. The Dundalk manager, John Daly, has just arrived as well, which is when the singing has started. And they're here basically to show their solidarity and support for the club, because they believe that Dundalk Football Club is more than just a club. It's a vibrant part of the County Louth community, and they're hoping that the club isn't about to go out of business. There was a 5 p.m. deadline put on saving the club. That will pass very shortly, but as I understand, the owner, he's in talks with some people at the moment. I got through to him a little bit earlier on, and he said to me that he was hopeful.
That was drive time, about 4:45 on Monday evening. 25 hours later, Tony O'Donoghue is back at Oriel Park.
What exactly are the details that we know about this, and does it mean that Dundalk is now saved?
Well, hopefully that's the case. It looks like yesterday when on the programme we heard the concerns of Dundalk fans, and their fears have been allayed, I think, because a local Dundalk-based barrister, John Temple, has been involved in negotiations with Brian Ainscough, and the deal was brokered and legal documents have been signed, I understand. And so John Temple's consortium is the preferred bidder, if you like, will take on an 80% stake of the club. The other 20% stake is for four minority investors. There's actually a meeting of the 1903 Supporters Club this evening, and it's expected that John Temple will speak to the supporters that we heard yesterday on Drive Time. And they're certainly relieved that this looks like the club's future for the moment, at least, is secure. Is almost too strong a word to say, because, of course, we don't want the same mistakes to occur again. So it's up to the FAI, I guess, to look into the new consortium and to make sure that they do financially and otherwise fit the case for Dundalk.
So it looks like some white smoke there at Oriel Park, as reported on Drive Time on Tuesday. On Sunday Sport, it was deja vu all over again for Rory McIlroy. After a second shot for the gods on 18, he had this putt to tie and go into a playoff. Gary Morden is your commentator.
10, 11 feet tops, I would say. Eagle putt. Sets it on its way, and it's going to miss by a fraction on the right-hand side. And McIlroy bends over and just is dismayed with the result. McIlroy defeated once more in a tournament that he was desperate to win.
And Greg Allen got McIlroy's reaction afterwards.
Played well this week. That roar when I hit that second shot on 18 was pretty cool. Yeah, look, the support I got out there this week was absolutely amazing. I've had a great time being home. You know, if anything, it just whets my appetite even more for Portrush next year.
And one sportsman who certainly got the result that he wanted spoke to the News at One on Monday. Freshly minted Irish citizen and rugby great Bundy Aki.
It's been 10 years since I've been here, so, you know, I've been here for a very long time. And I've enjoyed my time here in Ireland. I've embraced the people, and the people have embraced me and my family as well. So I know a few of the lads will be like, I don't know how you're getting a citizenship. But look, I know they're all delighted for me, and my family's also delighted. And look, I'm going to enjoy this moment and cherish it. It's not a bad word I could speak about Ireland.
And you're here to stay?
I'm here to stay, yeah.
That's Bundy Aki there. Connacht and Ireland rugby great and Irish citizen, as per the News at One on Monday. On the Oliver Callan Show on Thursday, it was Monaghan all the way. They celebrated an exhibition in the County Museum, and Barry McGuigan joined Oliver on the phone.
He's the boxing legend who once actually was the face of my pyjamas in the 1980s. Barry McGuigan, good morning to you.
Do you know, I think he's actually lost for words.
Good morning, Oliver. That's a blast from the past.
I'm afraid, I don't think you got any licensing money from any of the PJs, because there were...
I don't think I did, to be honest.
There were stalls in Carrickmacross and Jonesboro filled with very questionable merchandise, but it ended up at home.
Always was.
After dispensing with Oliver Callan's pyjamas, the chat was particularly interesting about the border. Younger viewers, take note.
I grew up with the border. I mean, I was born in 61, didn't start boxing until 73, but the troubles had already sort of begun. And you couldn't help be affected by it, because mum and dad had a grocery business. Dad was a traveling musician, traveling in and out of the north. And so you spent your life going over the border and back. You know, it was just there. You lived with it. You accepted it.
And some of those cross-border journeys could be particularly interesting.
You couldn't jump a queue. There was no way you could do that. But when you queued up, and normally you'd be stopped, you'd get out, you'd have to open your boot. The normal time to Enniskillen would have been half an hour. Mm. But with the checkpoints, it could be an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So it really crucified the business that came into the town.
One of Barry McGuigan's early decisions when he turned professional was to, so to speak, nix the nicks.
I wouldn't wear colours, because everywhere you went, Oliver, every corner you turned, there was a tricolour up the IRA, or there was a Union Jack up the UVF. And I just was sick to death of it. People were dying every day. And I wore the United Nations flag of peace on my shorts. Our shorts were made out of those colours, just blue and white. And Dad sang Danny Boy. That was our anthem. And that was universal. And everybody loved it. And everybody sang it back. And it was very emotional and very tense, you know, because you're about to go in and put your life on the line and fight for semi-final for the world title and then the world title. You know, it was a very tense time. But if you could recapture what happened in Loftus Road when I won the world title against Eusebio Pedrosa and played it back, everybody sang that song, and I tried my best to not listen to it and just blank it out and hum a little tune or something, just to keep in my head together and trying to be calm.
A Monaghan quorum, if ever there was. Barry McGuigan speaking to Oliver Callan on Thursday. Later that day, John Cook was on Drive Time, meeting some new Gardaí who were due to graduate yesterday.
My name is Jane Taylor. I am from Dublin and I'm 26 years old. After finishing secondary school, I studied Russian and Italian in Trinity College Dublin. And then after that, I joined Accenture, where I was a content moderator for the Russian market, where we worked for the Google project and moderated videos for terrorism, radicalization and hate speech.
Terrorism videos?
Yeah, terrorism videos, yeah.
Looking at some pretty nasty stuff?
Yeah, yeah, they would have been difficult enough. A lot of videos of, you know, like mutilated soldiers and a lot of that kind of thing. So then after that, I joined Aer Lingus, where I was cabin crew for a year and a half. And I was doing...
Big gear change there.
Complete 360, going from an office to going to the skies. But yeah, I really enjoyed that. And then after a year and a half, I got the call to join a Garda Síochána. And that's when I left Aer Lingus and joined.
Mancunian Kieran Fagan is also a new recruit.
My great-grandfather was an inaugural member back in 1922, and I'm the first person in my family since him. So I grew up with stories from my grandmother of how policing was back then. And, you know,
very
different now. But, you know, I just feel so honoured and proud to represent my country.
Pavel Skutela says Ireland gave his family a better life.
But I think it's good to have a wide variety of people from diverse backgrounds, because some people mightn't be able to speak in English. So it's good to know extra languages, and I think that would be a good thing too.
With anti-migrant sentiment and more hostility towards Gardaí shown at recent protests, I asked Pavel if he's concerned about abuse on the beat.
It doesn't worry me at all. I kind of consider any form of hate directed towards me as motivating in a way.
Every single guard in the country was, you know, concerned about their safety, and you did experience abusive comments. It's just the job that we're in now, and we have to just grow a thick skin and not take it personally and just separate yourself. It's not personal. It's just, unfortunately, if you're in these roles of, you know, law, it will happen.
That is the calling that I have, helping people, helping the communities and being there for people at the worst times of their life. I want to be that person they can go to and that they can look towards me if they're struggling and they need help.
From Drive Time, John Cook. August 3 Gardaí Nua. Back to Brendan O'Connor at the weekend. The winter is coming, but do you know where your stopcock is? Elaine McFerrin gave Brendan 5 easy pieces of DIY advice.
With anything in plumbing, it's clockwise is closing it. So righty tighty, lefty loosey is the analogy we sometimes use for that.
So look, if people take nothing else away from today, locate your stopcock and remember righty tighty, lefty loosey. That's your first responder situation in plumbing.
Totally.
And continuing the playback advice slot, I hope you have your pencil handy, because on Tuesday, Drive Time heard from Claire Ronan how to pack your shopping.
So you should keep your frozen food together, your fruit and veg together, the washing powder together, etc. So you've done all your shopping and your trolley is all organised into different sections. You then put it on to the conveyor belt, heavy items first, crushable items next, and fragile after that. Open up your bags. You put in your El Paso box or something to line the bottom of the bag.
My modus operandi is to shove everything into the bags and leave the eggs and the bread until last so they're not squashed.
I think it is cause for a divorce if somebody puts a tin of baked beans or a multi-pack of baked beans on top of your bread.
And that, gentle listener, is why I always have a separate bag for me loaves. By the sound of his chat with Brian O'Connell on Today with Claire Byrne on Monday, Jim O'Mahony has a separate room for his music. He's got an interesting way of assembling a great record collection. Pick the best 10 albums in every year. He writes a column on that very topic. He told Brian about 1964.
I came across this when I was about 8, when RTE one Christmas decided to show A Hard Day's Night.
It's Jim's pick for the finest record released in 1964.
I was absolutely blown away. And I kept singing the songs over in my head.
Why A Hard Day's Night? Like, what is it about that album?
It's one of the most perfect pop albums. Every single song is a potential single. Like, it's a perfect storm. Like, the most famous opening intro for any album is that that chord. And, like, it goes from that into I Should Have Known Better, If I Fell. Three completely different types of songs. And then not only did you have the songs, you were able to look I think it was the first time that people were exposed to a bit more than the single. Now people were saying, oh my God, this is an album. Imagine what it would have been like to have been a teenager into music in 1964, because you can sense all this amazing musical change coming down the tracks.
Jim O'Mahony on 1964. Also, on Clare Byrne's show that day, Adam McGuire took a look at all-you-can-eat deals. Sometimes they're good, and sometimes they're too good for the company to continue.
Coffee and sandwich chain Pret a Manger had an unlimited coffee subscription service in the UK. They're actually in the process of changing it now, much to the annoyance of customers. Their business model was built entirely around being net close to offices rather than residential areas or shopping centres. So COVID was particularly bad for them. After that, they introduced this offer where a customer could get up to 5 hot or iced coffees per day. They also got a discount on food. It was £20 a month.
That's a great deal.
Yeah, £3, £4, £5 per coffee. If you're just getting one a day, you're going to be saving money. This, but it was clearly too good of a deal because they've changed the terms now. So from this month on, customers now only get half-priced coffees, 5 half-priced coffees a day. The discount on food is gone as well.
Not interested anymore.
Yeah, the
now.
Upside is it's only a fiver a month now, but there's a big difference between free drinks versus paying for half price. You don't
drinks.
Feel like you're getting that bargain.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to pull the wool over Claire's eyes when she has the likes of Adam McGuire in the studio waltzing her through the all-you-can-eat, drink, fly and whatever you're having yourself deals. That from the Today programme on Monday. And the last bit of advice on Playback this morning is to seek out any available podcasts or recordings of the RTE Concert Orchestra. On Saturday, Aidan Gormley presented a live Movies and Musicals programme on RTE Lyric FM. It featured Stephen Bell with the baton, the RTE Concert Orchestra, and Juliet Crosby on this glorious version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Till next week, bye-bye, and thanks for listening.